bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, it's the Photo Show. Yes, we're here to discuss the week's photographic news. Alex is away working, but joining me, Chris Forsman, is still here. How you doing, mate?
Doing pretty good.
Excellent. A good week, or so-so? You've been busy or not?
It's been an interesting week. Busy doing a lot of stuff that isn't real work, but stuff that's got to get taken care of. It's getting done. So.
Well, we had a bit of a rum week over here. We had Jessup's go belly up, as we knew, because we talked about that on last week's podcast. HMV went belly up immediately at the same sort of time just afterwards. And now there's actually a supposed tie-up that Jessup's are going to put camera stores in HMV stores. So two ailing, sick children have decided to band together for strength. And Jessup's brand is pretty poor at the moment, so I wouldn't have said that they were a good one to jump into bed with. Have you had much feedback? Have you written any articles on the Jessup's collapse or anything, Chris, on Ars Technica?
I haven't. No, I mean, you know, we talked about was it last week or week before? We were talking about how, you know, in the States, you know, like Ritz and Wolf Camera had combined in around 1999, 2000, and made this like giant chain. And now they've been closing stores left and right here in the States. And I think actually it's like its second time in bankruptcy. Like it was in bankruptcy and it was reorganized and they closed some stores and, you know, got rid of some duplication and things like that. And then we're chugging along for maybe 4 or 5 years. But now it's like the stores are closing all over and they're liquidating everything. So. I think that, you know, it's just a problem that, you know, I not to say Amazon's to blame, but, you know, we have this like legacy of retail that doesn't really work the same way in today's market anymore.
Well, no, you say that. And I think in the truest sense of what those two companies were trying to do in terms of retail, I would agree with you entirely. Their brand of retail and their magnitude of retail is not working. But now you guys have got Calumet in the US, correct? Mm-hmm. We've got Calumet too. And I've got to say, they do a very positive method of retail experience here in the UK. But this has come out today, Calumet Photographic, the future of photographic retail in the UK. As of late, the press is full of bad news about the retail industry due to high street companies going into administration, etc. They then go on to say about the failure of Jessup's and Jacobs is pretty poor, but they're committed to photography and never have been more committed. Jessup's got a long heritage of photo commitment, but they wanted to carry on and they wanted to make sure that people understood that their shopping experience was very, very good. They've also offered any Jessup's customers who need to return a product or manufacturer under warranty for repair, the opportunity to use the national storerooms of Calumet is open to them. So they will honour any warranty repairs that Jessup's have sold on to. And they've confirmed that they're committed to the retail environment and welcoming people through the shop door nonetheless. So there you go. You can shop online as well with Calumet, and their prices are very competitive in-store and online. So, I mean, how's Calumet doing in the States? Is that...
Well, I was just talking about how the Calumet has a pretty big store here in Chicago and a big distribution warehouse here in Chicago, and they took over the Ritz retail location that closed right off the Magnificent Mile here in downtown Chicago. So I think they're doing rather well, and I think I agree with you that there are going to be, I guess, maybe certain specialty retailers that cater to a certain clientele and provide a certain services. I mean, the tricky thing is, you know, like as professionals, you know, I ended up buying my new Canon off of Amazon because I knew what I wanted. I knew exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, they had a pretty good deal at the time. I already have Amazon Prime that I subscription that I pay for once a year, and then I get, you know, free second day shipping. So I knew I was going to get it fast. I was going to get it right before we went down to my folks for Christmas, and so we could use the camera then and you know, really try it out and get used to it. And, you know, the whole idea behind the camera, too, is that, you know, we've got our baby coming, so we want to have, like, really great pictures. Like, all day long, right? So, you know...
But, I mean, the key difference in what you're saying there is that you knew what you wanted. You didn't go to a camera shop and play around with a camera at their expense and their electricity at their time and walk away and go and get something else.
True, true. And, but, on the other hand of that is that... The trick with a lot of, speaking from an experience working at a camera shop, the pros that came in and bought the expensive pro gear kept the doors open for when the people who didn't know what they wanted would come in and talk our ear off all day, and then, you know, we'd sell them some inexpensive camera or something like that. So, yeah. You know, some of the smaller independent shops, aren't going to have the same thing that Calumet has, the kind of reputation that Calumet has, even if they are providing similar services for a much smaller geographic area. So
that's the key part, though, isn't it? That Calumet are providing a retail service that actually functions. They've got dedicated staff, very knowledgeable. I think the problem that you get here in the UK, and you get with a lot of pro shops, is when you're getting something that's very aimed at the pro, if you're not a pro, when you walk in, you feel a bit intimidated. You don't want to ask for the wrong thing because you feel they're going to take the mickey out of you. And, hey, mate, this bloke wants a... And you end up with a not the 9 o'clock news sketch on you. But they're not like that. I credit to them. Right. It's a very plausible and enjoyable shopping experience, even for the average retail customer, not just pros. But the key is whether Calumet can transition that from the pros. I mean, over there, it sounds like it's very much a retail environment, so they're getting retail and customers through the door for retail rather than pros, whereas here in the UK, Calumet tend to be have been an awful lot more pro to semi-pro end.
No, I'd say Calumet is more like that here, and I think that what they're trying to do is expand it, like you suggest, to, you know, I think it's just photography is really changing too. At the same time that customers, you know, people are becoming used to, like, buying things on the internet, and the buying process is just different.
Yeah.
Than it used to be. At the same time, photography is really changing. And so what we're seeing is that, you know, people aren't buying point and shoots. And I mean, you know, when I worked at the camera shop and we still sold film, it was still a big deal. You know, I mean, like, we would sell so many point and shoot cameras and it would be like $100 to start up to like $300 for point and shoot. And then the SLRs would start around $300, $350. You know, and there were, like, literally at every $10, there was a camera model for somebody.
Mm.
And, you know, and then, of course, we were selling film, and we were recommending different kinds of film for different things, and people were coming in and getting prints made, and there was a whole, you know, that was the reality. Now, you know, and then for a while, people were coming in and they were buying digital point shoots, and those were, and, like, you know, the price range kind of went up a little bit, so people weren't buying them as often or as many of them. Cameras started out like at $200-$300 and went up to like $500-$600 or more, you know, for a point and shoot, and then it was like even more if you wanted to get an SLR. It was like a, you know, $700-$900 to start, and then went up from there. So, you know, prices shifted, people's perceptions of what they were buying shifted,
yeah.
And how they bought shifted. And, you know, and then for a while, you know, the people were coming in and getting inkjet printers, and they were making their own prints at home. So they weren't making prints with us anymore, but they were buying ink and they were buying paper, and we had all different kinds of, you know, glossy and semi-gloss and presentation matte and, you know,
yeah, I mean, those days are gone.
Archival, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we were doing that, but now it's almost to the point where people, I mean, a vast majority of pictures are basically taken on smartphones. They're uploaded to Flickr or Instagram or Facebook or whatever, and yeah. That's that. There's no nobody's going to get a camera, and nobody's getting film or paper or ink or anything from their local camera shop.
I mean,
so that,
the smart ones recognize that. I mean, I recognized 10 years ago that you know, I wasn't going to be taking personal portraits anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. if you can spot that the market's changing early enough, then you can survive.
Yeah.
But it's whether you can or not. Talking of that, Kodak have joined the mirrorless camera revolution. They've brought out a Micro Four Thirds S1 mirrorless camera. He said it was quite a surprise for the camera world. But, I mean, there's a comment here on the blog that's posted it from a guy named Man's Game, and it says this is about 15 years late to make Kodak anywhere near relevant. If this was out in 1998, I think Kodak would have had a chance. Well, the mirrorless end of that wouldn't have happened in 1998, admittedly, but it is a nasty, cheap-looking camera, even at distance. The Pix Pro digital camera, there we go. Any thoughts on this, Chris?
Well, let's keep in mind that Kodak has been a sinking ship for a while now. Mm. They recently sold off a ton of their digital imaging patents to Google and Apple and a couple other companies, bought them up, and that's meant to kind of keep the company going for a while. But I mean this, and like most Kodak cameras since the 1950s or 60s, this isn't designed by Kodak. This isn't made by Kodak. It's they're licensing their brand, which is, you know, which is sort of like an ironic thing. It's like one of the few assets they have, but it's also an asset that really is losing value because people don't think of Kodak like they used to think of 10 years ago. I mean, Kodak was like the biggest photography company in the world 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Still. And now they're, you know, who even thinks of Kodak anymore?
They're irrelevant
honestly,
in terms
I don't.
Of the brand. Yeah, exactly. And I think the thing that's interesting here, the cherubs, we've had a problem with the feed going out and I've had to restart it and it's come on. And the first thing that's come up is a picture of this camera. And the first comment from Boo in the chat room is, that's one fugly looking camera.
Right.
And it is. It's not a good looking thing at all. On the top there as well. Now, that looks like that's an add-on device that's mounted onto a hot shoe for me as well. Maybe a GPS.
Well, and I'll say something about this flash too, because I was at the camera booths at CES, and both Olympus and Samsung seem to sell a version of this that to my eye seems identical. So I'm wondering, you know, if there's some OEM in somewhere making this, because it flips up. It flips up, so you can kind of flip it down to be a little more compact, and then flip it up when you need.
Maybe it's a radar array, says Teresa. It's a driving cap. Do you ever, in the States, old men put caps on to go driving?
No, but we know what they are here.
Yeah, GPS device. There we go. There's a point in the chat room here from Jim saying that it's a rumor that GE are making the camera, General Electric, which I find surprising. JK. Maybe,
yeah, JK Imaging is the company Kodak is partnered with. And it said, you know, and from what I know, JK is manufacturing the camera. You know, Kodak is branding it and selling it. GE does sell some cameras. They're kind of cheap. I don't know if they're actually designing and building them. I think they might do some of the sensor tech, and maybe GE is also a partner with this JK manufacturing.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, it does seem like a little too late. What's kind of interesting is that, you know, Olympus started this Four Thirds thing originally with Fuji and with Panasonic, and I think there was one other person involved in this originally when they came up with the Four Thirds sensor standard, and they wanted to have like a standard lens mount, and then they, you know, ended up adapting that to the Micro Four Thirds for the mirrorless cameras. And it's basically been just Olympus and Panasonic for the last few years.
Yeah.
And they've signed on this JK Imaging, who's going to be making these Kodak cameras. They also signed on a few other...
The
one company I know is Blackmagic, because they make this, like, you know, 2K cinema, digital cinema camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really kind of a indie film, you know, independent TV show kind of camera they've got. That's really interesting. And they're using Micro Four Thirds mount. So now they're going to, you know, right now it's just like a passive adapter, but they're going to make a version that has, you know, they can use legit Micro Four Thirds lenses from Olympus and Panasonic for it. So
there's quite a few have signed up as well, isn't there, on this? There's Olympus have confirmed that there are several that have signed up for it, five companies. JK Imaging, four other companies, which include Backmagic Design, have also signed up for the Micro Four Thirds format.
Now the other companies are Photron, Viewplus, Vizitech, Astro Design.
Some of these
are companies we haven't heard of before, but it's good that they're getting some more support behind the standard. And so that, you know, the Micro Four Thirds actually sell really, really well in Asia. Not as well on outside of the world, but it's still mirrorless cameras are really growing, and that's why you see Nikon making the one system. That's why you see Canon has, you know, kind of made their own version with the EOS M.
Yep.
Sony has the NEX. Samsung has the NX. So, you know, what's interesting though is that each of these manufacturers has decided to go. They've come up with their own system. They have their own lens mounts that really are only compatible with these systems. You know, so I guess if you decide to buy a Nikon one, then you are going to have to buy the Nikon lenses. And I think that's what they're thinking is like, you know, but maybe, I don't know, would it have been more successful if some of these companies had instead adopted the Micro Four Thirds standard? And then you could, you know, if you make really good Micro Four Thirds lenses, then maybe someone gets a Panasonic camera, but they still buy your lenses.
Yeah. I mean, JK,
I don't know. I mean, it's clear that's what JK is doing is instead of trying to come up with a whole new standard, you know, who's going to go out there and be like, oh, I really want a JK imaging lens, you know, with slapped on with a Kodak name. But at least if someone, you know, is interested in, maybe they're looking at a little bit low end camera, but then someone really likes it and maybe they buy some Panasonic lenses for it. You know, or maybe that appeals to them that they can get into this, you know, Micro Four Thirds at a lower price with this Kodak and with knowing that maybe they can move up later to like Panasonic or Olympus or whatever.
Mm.
So
the chat room's confirming JK is an affiliate of GE. Thank you, Jim. And Bookery says, isn't Konica the hot Micro Four Thirds mirrorless camera to get right now? Haven't seen it. And Trey Ratcliffe likes the NEX apparently.
Konica makes Micro Four Thirds?
He's saying so. We'll have a look at that, Jim. Bookery, come on, give us a link, mate. We'll have a chat about that, definitely. Google has refreshed Google Image. It's completely different now. So when you get all your images up and they all come up in a block and grid, when you hover over them, they don't zoom in anymore like they used to. But when you click on them, you've got a little expanded view of the image, and it gives you the choice of going to the website, looking at the original image, or going back to where you were. And I've got to say, in terms of stealing images, it makes it tons easier because you haven't got to open the web page anymore. I like it. It's a winner for me. What do you think?
You know, that Zoom thing was just always so annoying.
It could be. I did find it useful at times when you couldn't exactly see what the image was looking like, but I like this now where it opens up in a new box. And like I said, the options that they give you are very much more, when you do open the image to have a look at it, it says, do you want to visit the page? Do you want to view the original image? Or do you want details of the image? So typically before, you know, whenever you clicked visit the page, you never always knew where you were going beforehand. And you don't have to do that now. You can just look at the original image and be done with it. Which again, you know, the cookies aren't loading up in the same way and all that kind of stuff on your browsing habits. So I like it. I think it's a good addition. Definitely a good addition. Well done, Google.
Yeah, I like the reverse image search too. That comes in handy sometimes. Interestingly, I think a lot of people really don't know about it.
So go on, explain, because I don't. I have to admit.
Oh well, So you can give Google an image, and it will go out and find anywhere that it's crawled on the internet that has that an image that, you know, the same image.
Oh, we did talk about this, sizes. Didn't we?
I've used a service before called TinEye for a long time. That's what they originally came up with. That was their whole point of being, is you could do these reverse image searches. But I find that obviously Google's catalog is much more complete, I guess.
Yeah.
Than TinEye. So, you know, you usually get easier to get a positive hit on something you know exists elsewhere. A lot of times what I like to use it for is when I want to use an image for a news article, you know, a lot of times it's just like on some blog somewhere, and I want to try to, if I can, find the original source and make sure I'm crediting them properly and linking back to the original source whenever possible. So I usually try to do reverse image searches when I can't verify the source of an image.
Mm.
There's
it's an add-on extension, isn't it?
What's that?
The Google reverse image search is an add-on extension to Chrome, and you can add it onto Firefox as well. They've done a link for Firefox.
But it's nice because you can just like drag in an image and find out where it came from.
Yeah,
I know. It's real interesting because there's a TV show here in the States called Catfish, and the whole concept is about these people who have met online and developed this relationship. And one or the other has decided they want to like meet this person in real life so they can have, you know, like a real relationship. And this documentary guy goes and he meets the people and they explain like, oh, I've been talking to this guy or this girl online for the last year or last 6 months or sometimes even longer. And, you know, we have these really like intimate conversations and we text each other and we chat on Facebook or whatever, but we've never met in real life. And so the first thing that he usually does is he tries to find out, like, is this person real? Because because I'd say 9 times out of 10, they're totally fake.
Yeah.
And so what people do is they get pictures, they find some profile on some other site, get all their pictures, make a fake profile, and use all those pictures. So he uses that reverse image search all the time to see if he can find out if the pictures are legitimate or, you know, if somebody has gathered them from some other source. So that's a very helpful modern dating tip that involves photography. Don't assume the pictures that people are sending you are legit.
No.
You can use Google image search to find out if they're real or not.
Another facility that's come out is Honey. Now, this is... I'm not entirely sure what this does, but if you're shopping online effectively, if you've got Honey, which is a plugin for your browser, comes up, you can use Honey to go and find you discount codes for Amazon, Wex, Calumet, any of those kind of places. And if they can find it and you apply the code, there's a good chance you'll save some money and they register the fact that they've supplied it. It looks a fantastic idea, but I can't see this lasting very long if it's genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is it? What do you know about it?
I know very little about the plugin itself, but I do know that I've tried, like, you know, because I get some like newsletters, and sometimes they'll be like, okay, if you come and spend $60, you get $10 off this discount code, or get free shipping with blah, blah, blah. And online retailers have these discount codes all the time, but you don't always know about them. And sometimes you can search, you know, Amazon discount code or whatever, but you'll get tons of hits. But a lot of times it's like expired codes or they're one time use and someone's already used it. Or so, you know, I think the concept is really good because, you know, these discount codes are out there.
Yeah.
And if you can find them, then you should be able to use them. But finding them is always the real chore. Like finding legitimate, non-expired codes can be really hard. So,
yeah, and it's supposed to be photographic stuff predominantly, isn't it? So we've got a question later that's asking us about buying a 600D. Let's go and look for a 600D on Amazon, which we've done. There we go. And... if we go to allegedly now extensions, And I'm having trouble finding extensions for some reason. Here we go. Tools. Come on, Chrome, you lazy git. That's frozen. Oh, there we go. It's unfrozen. Tools, extensions. Do I have to add it to my basket first or not?
I would assume so, yeah.
How do I get it to work? I can't get it to work. There we go. I will have a play over the week. We'll tell you next weekend if we actually get it to work. There we go. That's all the news, I'm afraid. There is no more. It's not particularly brilliant this week. Bad luck. Your questions, then. Your questions. We've got two good questions that have come in. Yeah. First one's... we'll do them in reverse order, I think, because the first one's quite short. The second one's quite a lengthy one. Question one here from Ian Lewis. Hi, guys. Keep up the great work on the show. Not actually in the market for an upgrade, but just wondered what the benefits between cropped sensor DSLR and full-frame DSLR are. I've gone from a compact to a bridge to a DSLR and a recent upgrade on DSLR, but still cropped. I shoot mostly landscapes. I understand the low light benefits of a full frame DSLR and the fact that these models normally have a faster frame rate, but I don't see how this would benefit a landscape photographer anyway. When the day comes, do I save the pennies on a crop sensor or go the natural path for a full frame, which also potentially means some lens changes?
Well, this is a good question. And the answer isn't, you know, it's not a black and white easy answer. The benefits of a cropped sensor are, there's a couple. Typically, the camera will be smaller. The sensor itself is smaller. So the lens box, the mirror box, the viewfinder, all that stuff can be smaller. And the other benefit is that you sort of get this natural extra telephoto effect. So if you shoot things like sports or nature, wildlife,
cropped is good.
Yeah, cropped is good because you get like this extra magnification.
Your 400 mil lens that's only going to cost you sort of £500 or £600 suddenly becomes a 600 mil lens.
Exactly. So those are some of the benefits of the crop sensor. And the frame rates between crops and full frames usually aren't that different. It just tends to be that the higher end cameras have faster frame rates. You know, you spend a couple thousand on a camera, they're going to put in more RAM and better memory buffers and things like that that let you shoot pictures faster. And also at the high end is when they tend to be more full frame cameras. You know, but Canon makes a version, or I should say, both Canon and Nikon make like basically a professional crop sensor camera as well. Their newest models have been full frame sensors, so like the D4 is a full frame, and it's really good. And the Canon 1DX is also a full frame, and that's sort of more recently. That's kind of been where a lot of the, I guess. Innovation is going on in camera design. The benefit of the full frame sensor is like you mentioned, you typically get better low light capability because the sensor is larger. So the individual pixels, photo sites tend to be larger and those can gather more light. So they work better in low light. The other benefit.
But as a landscape photographer, that's not going to make a huge difference because you dial your ISO down to improve quality of capture and elongate your exposure.
Well,
you won't notice a huge difference.
Sure. What I was going to say with a full frame, though, that you benefit is that wide-angle lenses, which landscape photographers tend to use more, tend to be, you know, whereas like if you're using a crop sensor camera, you might need to get like a really, really expensive 14-millimeter lens. If you're using a full frame camera, you could probably do just fine with a really good 28 or 24 millimeter instead. So crop sensor cameras tend to lose out some on the wide angle, and then you have to get even wider angle lens to get those kind of vista like views. So that's the really, I think, for landscape photography, I think that's the real possible downside. And yeah. That's only possible if the lenses that you have now aren't really getting what you want.
I mean, the one thing that bothers me about the whole crop frame versus full frame thing is the fact that it's seen as an aspiration to own a full frame sensor camera, and it's not. It's the size of the sensor is not aspirational. It's financial, yes, because generally full frames are going to cost more than your crops are, but when it comes down to it, unless you're at the far end of photography, if you're talking about being a high-end sports photographer in relatively poor-lit environments and in arenas and things like that, or if you're talking about going out and doing commercial nature photography where you're trying to submit to National Geographic, you know, and you're shooting in the middle of the Arctic just as it's about to become winter, then yes, it's worth investing the money in that kind of stuff. But for what the average person shoots, even up to what the average pro shoots, I mean, if you look at me, you know, I shoot commercial stuff, I shoot bridges, buildings, planes, that kind of stuff, roadways. I've got a crop sensor camera that's my backup body, and I don't bother at all, because I'm not worried in the slightest if I have to swap between the full frame and the crop frame, because it just means I just can't use the same lenses at the same distance. I've got to be a bit further away. My 35 mil's now a 50 mil, and that kind of thing. And it, when it comes down to it, you should be judging what you're going to shoot based on how much is in the frame. So fill the frame with interest, and that doesn't matter whether you stood forward, stood back. If you're using wide-angle stuff, if you've got a 12 to 24 Sigma or something like that, which I have, then that makes an enormous difference, because then you're talking about shooting an 18 to 30 mil. And you're overlapping with other lenses. But wide angle's wide angle. You know, if you go a bit further back, it'll still look very similar. If you want that true bowl effect, then yes, you're going to have to use a full frame sensor to get the full 12 mil kind of barreling and goldfish bowl style of image. But for 99% of photographers, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference. It will do if you've bought EFS lenses, though, because they won't be of any use.
Right. I think that Nikon has set their cameras up, so if you get the DX lenses, which are designed for the crop sensor cameras, you can put them on FX cameras, and then it just sort of uses the middle of the sensor, so you can still use the lenses. What I do know is on the Canon side, if you get the EFS lenses that are designed for the crop sensor cameras, they just don't even mount properly.
No, the bayonet's different.
Yeah, to the full frame cameras, because the lens, the difference between where the sensor and the front of the camera is different on those full frame and crop sensors, and the you know,
if you got the mirror,
has taken advantage of that distance and to make the lenses like smaller, more compact, or whatever. So you put that on a full frame camera, and the mirror would actually, when it flipped up, it would crash into the back.
It physically bangs. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, good question. I think the one thing that bothers me is, like I said, you know, if you get back to me RAW versus JPEG article, people still think I hate RAW. I shoot in RAW most weeks or most days. The point is, it's a tool, it's an option, and that's the same thing with crop or full frame. It's an option, and it's a price-based option. So really, it's your pocketbook and your bank manager that's driving you more towards one than the other, than the physical artistry of the business of photography. Don't aspire to it. That's my point.
Right. I found, I moved up to a full frame camera recently. Part of it in particular was the low light capability, but the other part that I find that I really appreciate about the camera is a full frame camera has a much larger viewfinder, and when you think about it, it's not physically that much difference, but the percentage is much different, and it honestly just feels different when I'm composing and focusing and checking the depth of field and stuff.
But it'll feel different though if you're not used to it. That's
right. But it feels different enough to me that it was worth the extra money. That's, like I said, that's a very subjective thing, and that's not going to be the same for everybody.
No, I mean, I would agree entirely with you, Chris, because I mean, my backup body's a 600D, and my principal stills body was always a 1DS Mark II. I've now gone to the 6D because I wanted the low light for photography and I wanted it for the video. The video is a superior quality, and there's no question it feels better in your hands. It's a, you know, it's an alloy frame as opposed to a plastic frame. It's a significantly better camera. No question. So was it worth the extra money? Absolutely. I love it. Apart from all the issues I've got with Adobe, I love it. Bastards. Question from John, who's in the chat room. Thank you, John, for writing in. Firstly, at your advice, I looked at the 600D and figured that might be the right camera to get me started in DSLR photography. When I Googled, though, I keep getting returns for a KISS X5 and the T3i. They're Canon cameras. Excuse me. They're Canon cameras and look like the 600D, but I don't understand the difference. Any ideas?
Yes. The T3i is the US version, and maybe North America version. The KISS X5 is the Japanese version.
And
600D is pretty much everywhere else.
Well, my understanding as well is that if you buy those models, you're probably not going to get any warranty with them as well. There'll be a grey import in inverted commas.
Right.
The warranty that someone gives you is not something they're required to give by law. They do it as a sales pitch, if you like, in the UK.
I think in the EU, though, they electronics have to have a 2-year warranty.
Maybe.
That's a law.
Because maybe.
Because Apple got in trouble in Italy. Apple tends to offer a 1-year warranty everywhere, and then you get your Apple Care for an extra couple years. And they ended up getting fined by some kind of consumer group because there's an EU law that all electronics have to have a 2-year warranty automatically.
Great. Boo's agreeing in the chat room, so yeah, spot on. Didn't know that. Thank you very much, mate. See, you learn loads on this show, including me. But you might invalidate that warranty then if you buy that in, because that's not an EU-sanctioned item.
Right, yeah, if you get the KISS X5 or the T3i, they're definitely not EU market devices, and then so legally they don't have to give you a 2-year warranty.
John did send me a link of the one that he'd seen for the T3i, and it got in there, if you want to buy a warranty, it's another £60, but I can't say that warranty is valid, unless it's the camera shop is warranting it so that they can sell it as a grey import.
Like B&H does that for grey market products too.
Right, so they
have B&H warranty.
Okay, so it's like an insurance policy that they'll probably try and walk a mile from. The rest of John's question, which goes on for a while. Question one, what is a good starter lens and why?
Oh, well, I hope you got another 40 minutes to record.
I mean, bang for buck. I keep coming back to the 50mm. I was talking to a guy this week at a business, and he was saying, I'm thinking about getting the 50mm 1.8. I'm saving up for it. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you earn enough to order one of those right now. And he said, well, no, they're quite expensive, aren't they? No, mate, they're about £85. I see them as disposable. You drop them on the floor, you buy another one, tucks it in a skip, and away you go. And he was quite surprised he came back and he said, I didn't realise they were only £85. For £85, it's a great lens because it makes you move because it's a prime lens and you get the artistic quality of the 1.8. So that would be my start for 10. Don't get the kit lenses, the 18-55 kit lenses, always buy body only. And then if you want a cheaper lens, I think Canon do a 35-90, is it, or something like that? 28-90, is that the one? It's macro as well. 1-2 macro, I think. They're about £70 or £80, so they're not the end of the world either.
Well, they're about the same price. The 28-90, it was for film cameras. And the 18-55 is more or less the digital version of that for crop sensor cameras. And they're about the same price. The 18-55 is actually a little more compact. So if you zoom is convenient, but it's so dark. Like, I just avoid that lens if you can. It's convenient, but you're gonna end up.
I mean, it's 3.5 to 6.3, isn't it? Is it 5.6?
Yeah. I think it's 5.6 for the.
I got 6.3 in my head for some reason, but I believe you.
Yeah, I mean, it's dark. I mean, the pictures you're gonna get out of it are gonna look like they look like snapshot pictures, frankly.
Yeah,
you know, your pop-up flash is always going to pop up because the aperture is so dark. You know, just avoid it. I mean, just avoid it. If you avoid it, then you're going to make yourself use other higher quality lenses, and it's also going to force you to pay more attention to composition and things like that anyway. So it's just, if you're going to bother at all getting a good lens, just like like you said, start with a 50, maybe even go crazy and get the new 40 millimeter pancake.
That's a good lens. I mean, that's 290 quid's worth, and that's well worth doing. Jim's mentioned as well the 35mm prime. That's 200 quid to buy from Wex, and that's a good quality lens again. And look on eBay. I mean, this week I've just gone and bought myself 24-70 2.8 L-series lens. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the Series 2, and actually there's a lot of reviews saying it wasn't as good as a Series 1, and I found a Series 1 for 800 quid secondhand, so I bought that instead. eBay again. There you go. Hello, James Fisher over in Westbury. Thanks, mate. Good lad. Question two: why do you need filters? You don't.
This one is interesting because a lot of filters were important for film photography that they just aren't really necessary for digital photography anymore.
Yeah.
Like color temperature balancing, or you know, and back in the days, you'd use filters for black and white film, and they would give you different contrast ranges and things like that. It's just all those are pretty much irrelevant because all of it can be done with the click of a button in Photoshop at this point, or even sometimes with a click of a button right on the camera, like some kind of like built-in filtering effects. So I would say the main thing filters are used for now are lens protections. So you get kind of a
stop you smashing the crap out of it.
Yeah, just protect the front element, and they make these really nice clear optical glass filters you can put on the front and keep you from getting smudges,
which are vastly crap. Overpriced for what they are, but there you go.
And some people have already, you know, why would I buy this really great lens and put a piece of glass in front of it when they've already designed it for blah blah blah. I mean, there's people who have arguments either way, and I understand both. I mean, I've run into both situations, so I get that. But that's one reason. The other reason is a polarizer, which is something that can't be done digitally. I mean, you can fake it, but it's not the same. But polarizer lenses can reduce reflections from non-metallic surfaces, and they can also like deepen colors, particularly in the sky or foliage, where you would get a lot of like scatter reflection from sunlight. And a polarizer can limit that scattered light, block it essentially, and just let through the a pure polarized light, which will give you deeper colors. So if you talked about landscapes before, if you shoot a lot of landscapes, a polarizer is a really good filter to have. And neutral density, people still use neutral density filters. So
Yeah, and it's really worthwhile if you're worried about burning out a sky or something like that, or you want to just tone down. Say, if you're shooting snow, there's a good example. It goes very, very white or grey. Just tone it down a little bit, and that'll give you that little bit of flexibility for dodge or burn afterwards, or exposure. Yeah, I wouldn't buy anything apart from a UV, and UVs are fairly pricey. But
polarizers are the most expensive ones for sure.
Yeah, and the bigger the diameter. So if you're looking at buying a lens, think about, if you're buying a 52mm lens or a 55mm lens on the screw thread, then you're going to get far cheaper on all of the stuff. I've got filters galore. Give me a shout. I'll sell you one. What type of filter should I be looking at to start with? Just UV. Don't buy anything else. And for decent bag to start with, how long's a piece of string, isn't it?
I've always been a big fan of Tamrac, but I haven't bought a camera bag in, I have not bought a camera bag in maybe 7 years.
Well, so the problem
even what to recommend anymore.
Well, the problem that you've got is that I've got a fetish for buying camera bags. My wife has berates me every week because once a week a bag comes that I think will do the job far better than the one that I have. This one was recommended in an email or a tweet. It's a no-name shoulder bag that just slings across the front of you, and it's got a top pouch and it's got an open side. That was £29 brand new, and as you can see, it's completely and utterly unused. I've never had anything in it whatsoever. So if you want one of those, John, you can have that for a tenner. There we go. Come to the bash next year. And the other one I got this week, which was really cool, is this rucksack, and I got that from a Chinese supplier. It's 24 quid. But it's got a nice little pouch on the top that you can put your card wallet in and that kind of stuff, or you can put pens, pencils, that kind of thing, your phone. It's got a nice little phone strap wallety thing that goes on here, look, you can put in. And inside it's got room for all your lenses. It's got little foam inserts and stuff, so you can drop your SLR in there with the lens pointing down. And it's got room for your laptop at the back. There you go. See, that was £29. £24, I think. £29, something like that. It's got some bags in the front. There you go. Never had anything that either. Hang on, I've lost my earphones. If you want a bag, don't go to a shop. Come and see me. Because I've got shed loads of the damn things. But I mean, there's tons of bags out there. eBay's a good place for bags. And I've got to say, the quality of the bags that are coming out of China now from some of the Chinese retailers, you might have to wait 25 to 30 days to get them. But when they get here, nothing wrong with them at all. They're not cheap and nasty anymore. Second-hand bag. There we go. That's the end of John's question. It took a while. Right. This podcast and all the others is brought to you by UK2.net. Please support them because they support us. All you've got to do is, if you want anything for the web, go to britishtechnetwork.com. Click on our sponsors link. You'll find the UK2 logo there. You can use it to sign into your account and that'll show you're a returning customer. Or you can go and buy stuff for yourself. And when you do, if you come back to the sponsors page, there's a whole pile of discount codes there that you can put in to get your money right down in your shopping basket. And they're all valid and they all work and there isn't a problem with any of them. So there you go. Do give them a shot. And do remember as well that every time you buy from UK2, you're supporting British Tech Network, because we don't get any money from them, but they pick up all the bandwidth and it's horrific. We had 65,000 downloads of the Max Show last week. So we'd be lost without them. Really, really would. Thank you so much. Mr. Forsman, where can we get a hold of you?
Yes. You can find me on arstechnica.com or on the Twitters at Forsmac.
Excellent, mate. Thank you very much. All right for next week?
Yeah.
Good man. Thank you. And you can get me, Ewan Rankin, on at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. Available for commercial photography work, happily. Thanks very much. Got a nice year this year. It's very balanced. Love it. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.